Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We are today in lesson 191. And in the last lesson, we're discussing the chapter of 36 of Genesis, the history, the genealogy of Esau. And some interesting details here that we have in this chapter. And that tells us also, that shows us why God records certain details that on the surface, you know, they seem to be irrelevant. And yet God spends quite a bit of time, and here it is, a whole chapter. Major events that happened in the history of Israel, and God spent only about a verse or two discussing them, and here it is, a whole chapter. And if we see it from God's point of view, the entirety of the picture, and the fact that there is still a future coming for Esau, 1,000 years and beyond that, and that will give us a little bit more of an understanding why God spends a lot of time on things that seem to be little details or trivia or whatever it may be. Anyway, you know, there is another point here that I wanted to make, and that's concerning Uz, one of the sons that came out of Esau. And so we read in verse 21 again, something that is very interesting. God is recording the genealogy of a people that were not Israelites, they were not the sons of Edom, but they are the people that Edom apparently totally integrated with, and therefore they became a part of the people of Edom by marriage first, and then by intermarriage with others. And, you know, as time went by, they became basically Edomites. That's in essence the way it happened, just like, you know, Jacob. He goes to the family of his mother, and he marries Rachel, and he marries Leah, and then he marries two more women. And they are not, you know, daughters of Abraham or of Isaac. And yet, they bring forth the 12 tribes, you know, the 12 sons, and Dinah. And all these people become one people, one family. And so it is apparently here, even though these people were not related to begin with. The children of Esau, and so that's the reason why we read in verse 20 about these Horites. These are the sons of Seir the Horite, the inhabitants of the land. Now they are people of Seir, they are Horites, they are not Israelites, and they lived in that area, and Edom went over there, that is Esau, and conquered them, and they became a part of his nation. And so we read that he had, you know, several sons, and then verse 21, and Dishon and Ezer, you know, and Dishon, some more. Dishon is the one we want to concentrate on. And these are the chiefs that came of the Horites, the children of Seir, in the land of Edom. And this is what makes it important, that they were in the land of Edom, therefore integrated with Edom, even though at this point they are not yet. But as time went by, you know, they intermarried with each other, and they had children and from each other, and therefore they became one people. And that was, in essence, the nature of things. And so, from this Dishan, we read later on in verse 28, he had several sons. And so we read, these are the children of Dishan, Uz, or Uz in Hebrew, and Aran. Now, Uz is the one that I want to concentrate again on. Uz is a very important person. On the surface, you may not see that, but when you realize the history of Edom, that is, they migrated from this area. In other words, they multiplied, and the place was not enough for them. God increased them. They had many, many dukes. They had actually about 14 dukes, I believe. And they became nations, so obviously they were men of cattle, men of the sword at the same time, and the place was just too small for them, and so they kept traveling first nearby in the east, and then toward Babylon, the old country where they came from. In other words, the children of Edom, not the children of Seir, but ultimately even the children of Seir came from there, because everybody came from that territory after Noah. And there they established a place which they called by the name of their father, Uz, or Uz in Hebrew, and everybody knows this name by the name of Oz, because of that famous fable of the Wizard of Oz. And in this Oz, people that came from both Edom and Seir, which were now integrated, lived, and in that very place, a very interesting person was born that everybody knows, at least those who are students of the Bible. There are even lots of people who do not know much about the Bible, but they know about Job. You hear about Job's daughters and so forth. But this Job is a very interesting person, and when you think about it, you know, he's not an Israelite. Well, what is he doing here in the Bible? A whole book about him. And he's not just an ordinary person. And when you think about it, you know, I have a little background there, how you get to this point. Esau was a son of Isaac. He's a grandson of Abraham. And Esau was raised, you know, with his father, you know, with all of his problems, to know the laws of God. He kept the Sabbath, he kept the holidays, he was circumcised. He kept all the teachings that Isaac taught him. After all, Isaac was a man of God, and Isaac saw God, spoke to God. You know, Esau is very much aware of that. So all this time, you don't see Esau, obviously, in a pagan religion. But he walks in the path, in the footsteps of his father, at least to a degree. You know, he's not as righteous as he should be, and he's got his problems. But his religion is the only religion that he was taught by his father. And so obviously this is the religion that he teaches his children. And as imperfect as it may be as time goes by, but still the basics are there. And later on, even in history, we still find out many, many, many centuries down the road, the children of Edom still were circumcised. And just gradually, as time went by beyond that they ceased to do it when they became a part of what became known as the Catholic Church. And so, obviously, when he goes and conquers Mount Seir and the Horites and they intermarry with them, well, he's the dominant one, he's the mighty one, and his religion is the one that prevails there, obviously. And at the same time, you know, there is a little mixture of paganism there. And that was constantly the same also with the children of Israel. So basically they have a parallel history there. And so obviously whoever comes from them has a good measure of the knowledge of God. And as we would call it today, the truth. And so when we have a descendant here that comes out of this family, out of this people, be it Edom himself or Seir, the one he intermarried with and they integrated, and also the religion, obviously, will be the same for both. Otherwise, it couldn't be integrated. And so when we find this history about Job, we find a man that knew the law of God, that knew God, that obeyed God. And so, you know, when you realize his background, that his father, we don't know how many generations in between, was a man that knew God. That is Edom. And the other one came to know God later on. As it is in those days, all the nations of the earth at the time knew the God of gods. That's why God could come and talk to Abimelech, and he could come and talk to Pharaoh. And even though they had already the pagan gods, they still knew about the chief God. So it was not a world in total ignorance and in total darkness. And so they will read about Oz or Uz. In Job chapter 1 and verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz. And where is that land? And why was it called Uz? You see, and that's where we make the link here with the children of, say, the Horite, who integrated with Edom, and therefore became a part of Edom. And this probably is a descendant, and he could be either directly descendant from Edom, or say, the Horite, because the people obviously integrated and became one. So another, you know, they were not distinguishable anymore. And so this man was a product of that, and he's a righteous man. So probably he could have been more Edomite, and then we can see it by his friends that he was more Edomite than from Seir. And yet the place was named after the, you know, one of the sons of Seir. And so we read about the land of Oz, or Uz, whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. So you're talking about a righteous man. And God thought very highly of him. And so later on, and he was a very rich man that God blessed abundantly. He was a mighty prince among his people. And so when God discusses this man, he basically tells Satan about him that he is a very, very righteous man. So he says to him in verse 8, then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Why would he call a man in Babylon my servant? You see, if you read it out of the blue, so to speak, with no context, with no background, you know, you should be asking yourself the question, how does it get to this point? And most people just read it without even thinking about it, and just take it for granted, and that's not the way we study the Bible. And so, you know, that's the reason, you know, when we study the law, that gives us the foundation to an awful lot of things. And so Job here, you know, the story of Job, the whole book has its foundation in the book of the law in Genesis 36. Of all things, in a chapter that people would consider to be trivia, Esau, you know, who cares about Esau, some people would think. Well, that gives you an idea why God records many things that seem to be little details and irrelevant. They are very relevant to God. They are background to his people, to his servants. And so God tells Satan, you know, this man, and of course Satan knows this man, is a very righteous man. He lives in the land of Uz, in the land of Uz, which is in Babylon, as Jeremiah tells us basically. And you know, even here from the account you can see this is what it is. And so here we have a very, very righteous man. And then we read in verse 15 that after God allowed Satan to afflict Job and his family and his possessions and all that, at one point we read about while his sons were having a party, whatever it may be, birthday or a feast, we don't know exactly. We read here in verse 15 that somebody told him about the destruction that came upon his children in verse 14, and a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and when the Sabaeans raised them, that is, raided them and took them away, indeed they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And who are the Sabaeans? When you study biblical history, you find out that the Sabaeans were in that territory of Babylon, near the Chaldeans. And later on in the book of Joel, you read about the children of Judah being sold into the children of the Sabaeans. And that again was in that area. Present day will be more or less between the borders of Iraq and Iran. But anyway, in the Babylonian territory of ancient times. And then we read in verse 17 also about another group. And so we read in verse 17, while he was speaking, and another also came and said, the Chaldeans. Now we know where the Chaldeans are. They're again in the same territory. So it says, the Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So here we see the location of Uz, which is in this area of Babylon, and the Chaldeans are raiding it, so it's nearby, you know. Territorial, you might say, tribes that invade them. And so you realize that this is where Job was, in Babylon. But how did he get there? How did the name get that name? Well, Genesis 36 gives you the information and the background for it. And that's the reason why you see certain details recorded in the Bible that otherwise you would think that there is no reason really for it to be there. It's not that important in comparison to many other details. Well, it is. Gives you a lot of background to many things, and this is one of them. And so when you continue the story in Jeremiah, and a little bit more details in terms of the location of this particular place, and you go to the book of Jeremiah, where in the book of Lamentation, we mentioned that earlier, he is speaking about the destruction that came upon Judah by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. And we know very much, you know, where the king of Babylon comes from, and where the Chaldeans are, and he was the king of the Chaldeans too. And so while speaking about the destruction again of Babylon, he inserts this statement here in verse 21 of chapter 4 of Lamentation, rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom. So he's talking about the people of Edom in a particular place. He says, the daughter of Edom, you who dwell in the land of Oz or Uz. You see? So this is exactly where the children of Edom came from. You know, he didn't say the children of Seir, he said the children of Edom. And so in essence, this is what the background, this Uz that was originally from Seir, that intermarried with Edom and became a part of Edom. And obviously Edom is the majority, Seir was a minority, and so all of them become one people. And part of them came to this very area, and they called it after the name of their father, Uz. And so Jeremiah makes it very plain that Edom lived in the land of Uz. And it is in the land of Uz, or Uz, that Job rose. And so the whole book about Job is about a son of Edom that lives in the land of Uz. And that's in essence what you see with the Bible. And you put all these things together, and you get a lot of information there that becomes relevant, that otherwise, if you haven't done your research, your background, your homework, and put things together, you obviously would miss all that, and you would not even be aware of it. And that's the reason the people that really dig very deeply into the Bible, they are the ones that come across many details like that, and they are being illuminated. In other words, the Bible, you know, was written for the wise, not for the casual hobbyist or the casual reader, or the one really that does not care much about the Word of God. And he may come across certain parts, and you know, he would say it. Many of them, unfortunately, do that. Many of us say that, well, this is a boring section, I'm going to gloss over that and go somewhere else where I have real spiritual food. Well, lots of things are spiritual, but other things are not. And yet all of them are part of the same package deal. And God wants us to have it all. After all, this is the book of God, and it's not the book of men, and yet it includes a lot of details that have to do with men. And so in chapter 2 again, in Job, in verse 11, we read now about the three friends of Job. You know, after he had the great calamity, and he found himself in a horrible state, then three of his friends came to console him and encourage him. And mind you, he is in Uz, it's a land of Edom, so where are his friends? They're going to visit him. We read here. Now, when Job's three friends heard all of this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. You see? Now, these are people that know Job, you see, and they come to the land of Uz, and each one come from their own place. And obviously, he being an Edomite, you would think that they too, being his friends, would be of the same people. After all, in those days, even today, now, who are your friends? You know, you don't say, well, when I was in trouble, my friend came from France and one came from China. You see, it just doesn't work like that. Your friends are the people of your own kinsmen, your own people. Especially in ancient times, where people were not as migratory, you know, in other words, they did not migrate like we have today, in our nation of immigrants. And so your friends could be from any given country. But in the old days, you know, people stuck with their own. And so in verse 11 we read, now, when Job's three friends heard all of this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, earlier we already mentioned that the firstborn of Esau was Eliphaz, and Teman was also one of them. And Teman is south, and he lived in the land of the south. In other words, he migrated further down the road. And that land is still there to this very day. It is known to everybody by the name of Yemen. But Teman is the original name of it. In Hebrew, it's Teman. And so this particular friend is Eliphaz the Temanite. So he's the son of Edom, in other words. And Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamite. On a Matite. In other words, these are three Edomite friends. Also, each one of them knows God. You see? They're basically are righteous people. You know, they get some other ideas, and some of them have certain thoughts that should not have been there. And that's the reason why God was very angry with them. They did not really pinpoint the real problem that was there, the real issue there. And in either case, they're Edomites, and Job also is in the land of Uz, which is the land of Edom. And so you see how you can, from chapter 36, that seems to be sort of a trivia, get an awful lot of information that otherwise you would not. If you just skipped it, as the manner of many is, when they come to areas of the Bible where they think, well, that's not that important. Anyway, I just wanted to bring a little bit of information in this direction. And so continue, and then we go to the last verse of the chapter, and verse 43, where we end up with this chapter. The chief of Magdiel, the chief of Aram, these are the chiefs of Edom according to their habitations in the land of their possession. In other words, each one was in a different place as time went by. And this is Esau, the father of the Edomites. So God signs the chapter with the reality and the fact that Edom is the father of all these Edomites, and the people of Uz or Uts are also the people of Edom. And so this is a history that was preserved later on, obviously, by these very people. And to this very day, there is a measure of knowledge and understanding of that. Because these very names and these very cities and these very places where the people of Esau went are still in existence to this very day. And unless you go into the Middle East and study all this background, obviously this would be far out information for many, and therefore not interesting to many. Yet it is interesting to God. He made it very plain. He dedicated a whole chapter for it. And then now and then through the prophets, he comes back to it and it mentions certain places here. And also, obviously, it became very important in terms of knowledge and understanding of background and history to the children of Israel, that is, in specific, around the children of Judah. And how many of the children of Israel themselves fled into the Middle East, we don't know. But we do know when the enemies came, they just tried to go wherever they could to find safety. And the Middle East was obviously the place to go in different countries there, in the land of Moab, land of Ammon, later on Saudi Arabia, what became today's Saudi Arabia. Many fled into Egypt, that is, of the children of Israel. And then obviously the people of Judah were taken into Babylon, and they remained there, and then they spread throughout the known present-day Middle East. And so all these names, all this history, all these places, were more relevant to them. And for the children of Israel that went far away into the West, first Europe and then the Americas, obviously this became totally non-important information, far away, sort of little trivia. And so let's continue now after the history of Esau. And it's interesting when you go to the synagogue and they read this portion of the law, and after that they read a portion of the prophet that is relevant to it. And you can imagine that, even in the days of Christ, he went through that as he went to the synagogue in this particular time when they read this portion about Esau. And mind you, every single year, since Moses, you see, whenever the people of God worshiped God and studied his law, of course they had on and off periods, but generally speaking, since that time, since Moses, and in particular, with the people of Judah, this chapter about Esau is being read once a year. And so it's on their mind, you see, but it's not on the mind of, unfortunately, the children of Israel that totally departed from that. And it's also on the mind of God because there is a lot of future history. And so the portion of the prophet that they read is basically the book of Obadiah. And Obadiah is dedicated again to Edom. In other words, to the evil that Edom has committed against his brother. The punishment that God is going to bring upon them. And also, another part that they read here, depending on what community you go to, if you go to the Eastern Middle Eastern Jews, they read Obadiah, and if you go to the community from Europe, they read part of the book of Hosea that speaks about Ephraim in specific, and some also about the house of Judah and how they rebelled against God, and therefore the punishment is going to bring upon them. And obviously, as you read many other prophecies, God is going to punish them through Babylon, ancient Babylon, modern Babylon, and Esau is in the core of it. And so there you find the link even between the two. Let's continue now with chapter 37 and verse 1. We read, and Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's sojournings, in other words, the land of Canaan, and these are the generations of Jacob. Now mind you, first he's beginning with the generations of Esau, the firstborn. And throughout the Bible you'll find that out, even though Reuben's birthright. Well, even, you know, if you want to begin from the beginning, when you read about the genealogy, God first records that of the firstborn. He records first the genealogy of Ishmael, and then he goes to Isaac. And then he records the genealogy of Esau, and then he goes to Jacob. You see? And that's the way it continues. And then when you get down the road again, when Joseph became the preeminent in terms of the birthright, when God records the genealogy, he first records the genealogy of the firstborn, which is Reuben, and then the others. And so it is. And even with the blessings that God gave Israel through Jacob before he died, first he begins with Reuben. And so God still maintains those priorities in terms of the firstborn. They may have taken the birthright from them and given it to someone else. And so we read here, now these are the generations of Jacob. And we read here, in other words, God is going to tell another story of Jacob, which is very interesting, and he goes directly to Joseph. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. In other words, God is going to tell another story of Jacob, but in specific is going to concentrate on Joseph. And here he's not speaking specifically about the birth, you know, who was born, but he just wants to tell you a part of the story of Jacob. And Joseph is now the center core of the story. So Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. Mind you, Joseph was born in Babylon. With the exception of Benjamin, all the children of Israel were born in Babylon. And God brought them out of Babylon physically, and God told them to come out of Babylon spiritually, which unfortunately, you know, they have not done as they should have. That's one reason why when Joseph, that is when Jacob came before God, when God told him to come before him, as we read earlier, in a sort of a pre-Sinai ceremony, the first thing he told them to do is get rid of the idols that were with them, so they did not come out of Babylon. But here it is, Joseph, that came out of Babylon because he was born there. Apparently he seemed to be more righteous than the others, closer to his father and more obedient. At least he had to learn lessons, and he did, and he ended up as probably the most righteous among all the sons of Joseph. That is, the sons of Jacob. And so now he's still not in that position. He's 17 years old, and he was feeding the flock with his brethren, being still a lad, you know, he's still a youngster, and all the rest were older than him. And some of them were born about 10 years before him, so some of them were pretty close to 30, like Reuben and others. But, you know, he was tagging along. 17, you can still do an awful lot. In those days, people didn't go to high school or grade school or, you know, elementary school and all that, so that was your life with the sheep or on the farm. And so he was, it says here, being still a lad, even with the sons of Bilhah. Now, Bilhah was the maid that Rachel gave to Jacob, so obviously gravitated to them rather than to the sons and maid, and you know, of Leah and her maid. And so he was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, which is very interesting. He gravitated more to the sons of the maids rather than to the sons of Leah. And Joseph brought evil report of them unto their father. Sort of a tattletale, which is not too good of a quality. And apparently he just sort of, you know, was a, I'm right, you know, with a kind of an attitude, I'm more righteous than you are. I'm going to tell on you. Obviously nobody likes to be around people like that. That's a little bit on the self-righteous side. And it's not a person that really seeks peace. But, you know, to get them into trouble. And then we read in verse 3, something that even complicates matters more in the family of Jacob. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. And you can imagine what all the other brothers thought about it. And somebody treats one as a favorite. Obviously, he's saying by that all the others are inferior in many ways to this person, and they don't like it a bit. And so you might say that many of these problems that came here were really the fault of Jacob himself and not the brothers, you know, the way they reacted as much, even though they were guilty also. But when they were provoked in many ways, both by Joseph himself and other different things that he had done, and also by the mere fact that Jacob treated them in a different way than he did deal with Joseph, so obviously that was a formula for disaster in the family. And sometimes you find that among the servants of God, like with David and others. And God is not a respecter of persons. He loves all of us. He blesses all of us. He cares for all of us. And he doesn't treat us differently, in essence, when you think about it. He wants all of us to be his brothers, to care for one another and love one another. Well, this is not a way to go about it. And so that tells you an awful lot about human nature that is still in all of us, even though we may be servants of God. And so we read here in verse 4, and when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him. That's a natural reaction of the carnal mind. But even a person who is spiritual is not going to be comfortable with it. And so they hated him, and they could not speak peaceably unto him. One is because of what his father, that is their father, had done. The other one because of the attitude that it created in Joseph. Obviously, when Joseph realizes that, being only 17, well, he becomes arrogant and haughty, and he certainly was. And that's, unfortunately, it's a quality that you still find it to this very day in his descendants. While Joseph learned his hard lessons, and Jacob learned his hard lessons, you see, because he used to be deceitful and supplanter and all that, his children have not, with the exception of the few that God is calling. But, ultimately speaking, all are going to learn the lessons the hard way. That we have to be, according, you know, to the law of God, people of one mind, of one spirit, you know, not treat each other differently. You know, the law forbids us to do that. As you read, James and many others, Christ made it very plain. James was saying that, you know, if a rich man comes into your party and, you know, you put him on the front seat, while the poor man, you know, you put backward, he said, aren't you judges of the law? Well, obviously, you know, this kind of a behavior is contrary to the mind of God, the nature of God, and we should learn from that, not to be that way in our own families, in our own groups, you know, friends, whatever it may be. We should learn to love the people of God, all of them. And obviously, you know, we have special feelings towards certain people, but on the other hand, not to abase others and exalt some. And so we read here in verse 5, and Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, that is, brethren, and they hated him yet the more. So you can imagine, you know, the way he told the dream, what he said, and his attitude, and all that, that didn't add much to their love toward him. As it is, they were already having a very difficult time with this kid. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed, for behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and behold, your sheaves came round about and bowed down to my sheaf. Now, when he realized what is happening here, God is the one putting, you know, those things in the mind of Joseph, you know, these dreams. So there is nothing wrong with that. But that was not the problem. The problem is all those things that came around it, that aggravated the situation, the fact that he was treated as a favorite, you know, pet of his father. He gave him the special robe, which he didn't give to the others. You see, and God is not that way. God loves all of us. He blesses all of us. He treats all of us nicely. You see, he doesn't treat us with contempt. But he loves all of us, and he commands all of us to love one another, just as we love him. And Jacob wasn't doing it, and then Joseph, on top of that, because of what Jacob was doing for him and not for the others, that created a problem for him. And, you know, he was too young to comprehend and realize that, not humble enough, not converted enough, after all, he's just a kid. And so he aggravates the matter. And so even though God gives him these dreams at this time, which ultimately this is going to be his fate, God was not going to fulfill these things until Joseph had to learn hard lessons himself. In other words, God did not approve of his attitude, of his behavior, of his conduct. And certainly he was not being of what Jacob was doing. And so he made both of them, in essence, pay a heavy penalty for this conduct on their part. Jacob, losing his son, thinking all this time that he's dead, grieving, living many years, you know, from the age of 17, where Joseph was taken away, to the time that he was 39. It took him about a long time. For a period of about 21 years, Jacob was mourning. And Jacob was paying the penalty, you know, in essence, for his actions, and Joseph likewise, even though by this time Joseph's already at the top of the world, so to speak. But you can see how God is an equalizer, you know, equal opportunity employer, and that should teach us a lesson too. And unfortunately, even among us, you see that sometimes when somebody is exalted and the others are not treated nicely, you know, they feel downtrodden. You know, they're not being acknowledged for what they should be, for what they are, for what they deserve. And the person who is being exalted, oftentimes, walks around with his nose up in the air, and that creates even more problems for others. Well, that's basically what we find here. When we are in this condition, in this position, we should know for sure, from this example, many others, that God is going to make sure that everything is equal in the final analysis, and therefore it's best for us to humble ourselves, even when we are exalted, to walk humbly before God and before our fellow man, not in arrogance, you see, because the penalty is always very great, and the penalty is always sure, if not swift. It'll always be there, because God loves all of us. And that's in essence what happened here. And at this point, yes, God is giving him the dreams, but he's not handling it properly. And so his brethren said to him, verse 8, "Shall you indeed reign over us?" Well, they perceived it for what it is, and literally this is exactly what he did. But you see, God does not exalt someone to rule over his brethren until that person shows himself fit to be in that position. And just like with David, you know, he did not exalt him to be the shepherd over his people until David had to go through his own trials and learn humility. And even when he raised him and anointed him as king, while Saul was still the king, he allowed Saul to torment him, to chase him around, to throw him out of the house, so to speak, and he was in the wilderness, and life was not easy, and had a lot of lessons to learn, and for 10 years he was being persecuted before God saw it fit to raise him to the throne and get rid of Saul at that point. So in other words, you know, all of us should learn lessons from that, and that's the essence of the study of the law, in order to know what is the mind of God, what is wisdom, what should be, you know, should be done, and what should not be done, how should we behave. And that's in essence, you know, the nature of God is that we are studying. And those who study and take heed, you know, obviously they are the wise. The wise shall understand and walk likewise. And so his brothers hated him even more, because they thought, okay, now you've got the robe, now you think that you're a big shot, you know, you're going to reign over us. I mean, you know, we are your older brothers, you have no respect for us. And so they viewed it from the point of view that every normal human being would view these matters. And so they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. See, dreams, you know, you can't help it, and dream comes about, fine, but, you know, what he was saying it and the way he was saying it also. And they hated that. And he dreamed yet another dream, and he told it to his brethren, and said, "Behold, I have dreamed yet a dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bow down to me." Now here again, you would think by this time, you know, humanly speaking, he would learn his lessons and not do it again. Well, there again, he comes up with the same dream. Now, he's not responsible for the dreams, yes, God is the one, but he's responsible for his actions and his attitude and the manner in which he presents it, you see. And that's what the problem that God had to deal with in humbling Joseph, to remove that attitude from him and yet to preserve what he gave him. And so in verse 10 we read, "And he told it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said unto him," now his father, you know, is getting the picture here, something's happening to my son. He realizes that his attitude is not what it should be. He doesn't know at this point yet that God is the one giving him the dreams, but God didn't give him the arrogant and haughty attitude. That was his problem. That came from another source. And so he says to him, his father, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brethren indeed come to bow down to you, to the earth? Obviously, his father didn't like that. You know, his brothers didn't like that, and his father didn't like that either here. Now, of course, he still didn't know the source of the dream. But apparently, even, you know, the manner in which he told his father also rubbed in the wrong way. And so he was angry with that. So in verse 11, we read, and his brothers envied him. But his father kept the saying in mind. In other words, he began to perceive, you know, this dream comes one after the other. There's got to be something there, you know, besides just the attitude of Joseph. So at least he kept it in mind, but at the same time he rebuked him for the dream, and probably more so for the attitude that he had in telling the dream. Verse 12, and his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Joseph, and it's very interesting, Shechem is the one city where they fled from earlier, because, you know, Levi and Simeon killed everybody there, but by now nobody's there, so it's not a problem to go back there. And as it is, they're mightier now, they're greater, and people all around are afraid of them, so there was no issue there. And so they go back to the same territory. Apparently it was a nice, fertile area and was good for their flocks. So they went over there, which was a distance from where they were, which was more to the south, and apparently the south, obviously, and to this very day you see it, is not as fertile, is not as green as this area of Shechem, which is in Samaria, or today the West Bank. And in verse 13, we read, in Israel, said unto Joseph, do not your brethren feed the flock in Shechem, that is in that place, and aren't they over there? And so he says, come, and I will send you unto them. And he said to him, here I am. So he was obedient, which is fine. And he said to him, and it's very interesting, you know, his brothers now go to feed the flock while Joseph remains behind. So, you know, in other words, because of the problems and the frictions, obviously you can see that Joseph, to be with his brothers, because that would have been trouble, especially sending them far away. And they were actually quite a distance away. And so, you know, you can see, you can read it between the lines, and you can find out what is really happening here. And so he sends him over there anyway, because he wants to know how they are doing. And verse 14, we read, and he said to him, go now, see whether it is well with your brothers, and well with the flock, and bring me back word. But when you think about it, about this, why would Jacob ask his son to go over there and check? You know, obviously, they're big boys. They should be doing well. Apparently, since God was going to intervene here and is going to cause this whole process, you see, to happen, is let alone even Joseph recognizes that, and he tells his brother, you know, that whatever you've done to me, yes, you know, that, you know, you had your own attitude there, just like, you know, he had his own. But he said, God is the one that actually worked it out this way. So obviously God is the one now inspiring Jacob to actually do that, and he's going to also inspire the brothers of Joseph and use, you know, their own carnal human nature and their attitudes and their end to do what in essence God himself wanted done for the benefit of Joseph and the benefit of Israel. And it's interesting the way God works out things. At the time when you go through it, you don't know it. You know, it doesn't seem like that. Doesn't look like it is from God. You think it is calamity and wrong, you know, that happens to you without a cause. But then, you know, this gives us an idea how God works with situations, which means that we are, if in a certain attitude, if we are doing certain things, and we study a lot of these accounts, we begin to understand exactly, more or less, what God is going to do. And so that gives us a little bit more wisdom and more caution, you know, and to be careful about our own attitudes and our own actions, because soon enough, this is exactly what's going to happen. And so he sends him over there, and so he went out of the valley of Hebron. So he was in Hebron, and Hebron is south of Jerusalem, a warm place, and not too good apparently for flocks, as Shechem is, which is more fertile, more green. And so he came to Shechem. And that's a little distance, especially when you walk by foot. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was, obviously he didn't know where to go to find them. And the man asked him, saying, "What do you seek?" And he said, "I seek my brothers. Tell me, I pray you, where they are feeding the flock." Now here's a man, out of the blue, he sees a man asking him, "I want to see my brothers." Now you think the first question he would ask him, "Who are your brothers?" Well, he doesn't. Because obviously, there is an awful lot here that is not recorded. Everybody knows Jacob, Jacob and his family and his sons and, all that. You see, they're well known in the land. So basically, when you ask something like that, you don't even need to ask beyond that. And that again gives you a little bit of background there. And so he says, "I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray you, where they are feeding the flock." And the man said, "They are departed thence, that is hence, for I heard them say," how does he hear them say? And he's just a man, a local, native. Well, there again, he had a lot of background there to think about. And he said, "I heard them say, let us go to Dothan, or Dothan." Anyway, we're going to stop at this point and continue next time. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.